Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio is an examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the ineluctable, indelible, and indispensable influence of drugs on society. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs, nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when drug users are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. On this installment of Free Culture Radio, it's Wine Part 2. Today we're looking at a new phenomenon, the urban winery. And my guest is Renee Neely at Hip Chicks Do Wine. Renee, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, thank you.
Very cool. How did Hip Chicks get started?
Well, basically, Hip Chicks got started with a trip actually out to Oregon Wine Country. Laurie and I actually like to do a lot of wine touring on the weekends. And we basically fell in love with the Oregon wine industry and thought that might be something that we would like to do. So in order to figure that out, we basically got jobs, part-time jobs, out in tasting rooms out in the valley, and then also went to a local community school, Chemeketa Community College, and basically learned that we didn't want to grow grapes, that we really wanted to make wine. So basically, we started out with a 10-year plan, and that evolved into a 5-year to a 2-year to why the heck don't we just go ahead and start this?
Now, urban wineries are, they're a relatively new phenomenon. Wineries have been around for a couple thousand years, so relatively new is, maybe not the best way to put it. How long ago did you open?
Well, we opened back in 1999, and at that time we were the only urban winery here in Portland. Since then, there's basically at least 20 urban wineries in the Portland city limits, so... So relatively, yeah, you're right, new 18 years ago. There have been urban wineries before us, but they have since, of course, shut down even before we opened.
So we're here at your winery. It's in an industrial part of southeast Portland near the last working rail yard in the city. Yeah, this is the kind of place you'd have something like this. Nice tall ceilings, plenty of space. What kind of response did you get from the idea of opening up a thing like this?
I'm a little bit of shock, I know, first of all, that we wanted to do an urban winery. It just made sense to us because we didn't want to commute. We wanted to make the grapes do the commuting. We weren't going to grow any grapes, so it made perfect sense for us. Back in 1999, I think, partially people thought we were kind of weird because we weren't out in, you know, wine country itself. And also for the name, of course, because we were trying to have a little bit too much fun. Back then, people took their wine very seriously. So people have loosened up here in the last 10 years, which has been good.
How do folks in the industry view this this urban winery thing?
They like it. In fact, it's been copied a lot in a lot of other cities or towns. Basically, we started it up here, and since then, there is like urban wineries in McMinnville and also Roseburg. So,
gritty urban centers.
Yeah, you're right. So I think that it's something that people once say that we did it and we were successful at it, they definitely took that to heart and thought, hey, I can do this. If you can do it, then I can do this.
We were just talking a moment ago, the idea of buying grapes from someone else, that's not exactly new. I mean, people do that, right?
Oh, absolutely. Probably every winery here in Oregon, except for maybe one or two, buy at least some of their grapes. When you see that vineyard out front, that's not all of the grapes for that particular winery or vineyard. So they have to supplement, too, from other people that just grow grapes. They also may raise chickens. They also may, you know, raise cows or grow grass seed. Grapes happen to be one of the crops that they choose to do.
Right on. Are there some vineyards that don't produce wine themselves, or if they have a vineyard, do they probably produce some?
You know what? There are a lot of people that just grow grapes. Yeah, I mean, there are people out there that we know actually a couple of people that we do buy grapes from. They just, grapes is one of the crops that they choose to have. So they don't make their wine at all.
Hmm. It's interesting stuff. I mean, I found out about this phenomenon less than a decade ago, and you know, thought, wow, that's amazing, and then realized, oh my gosh, there are a few of them. You even have there's about a dozen, two dozen. How many are in Portland area?
There's actually over 20 right now. 20. Some do share space. Southeast Wine Collective, Urban Crush, they actually house different wineries besides themselves. So as many as like 10 people are making their wine at Southeast Wine Collective. So with that 20, you know, a lot of really, really small producers, like around 500 cases or, you know, 1,000 cases, nothing that's super huge.
The and full disclosure, my partner and I are members of your wine club. You do wonderful events, and Marjorie, my fiance, really wanted me to ask you about the way that you've built community here. I mean, was that an intentional kind of a thing, or is it just a thing that happened?
I think it actually happened really around, well, about the time we opened. It really was a sense of community, because we basically held a lot of the business association. Back then there was a Brooklyn Business Association, and we wanted to become part of that right away because we wanted to be part of the neighborhood. Our kid went to school up the street. Our kid goes to high school down the street. So basically he has grown up here, so definitely we wanted to be a part of the community right away. And so I think especially once we started our wine club, that was back in 2006, the sense of community has just really grown, because we have a lot of wine club members that have been in our wine club for a very long time, like over 6 years, like 70 people in our wine club, which is basically unheard of in other wine clubs. People usually jet out like after the first year. So I think with that longevity of that many people, we definitely have a sense of community.
And it's not just the events that you have here, which, I mean, you have some lovely events, wonderful music, and your food is tremendous. You also do some outreach, and you mentioned your son. You and Lori just said a moment ago she's about to make dinner for 30 and your boosters for your kids' football team.
Oh yeah,
that's I think this is brilliant. Do they and they do the parents do. Does wine ever enter the equation?
Actually, there is. We actually do a fundraiser once a year in the spring that is actually 50% of the wine sales from that night go back to the Booster Club. So we invite another winery, and they're gracious enough where they give half of their sales too back to the Booster Club. So yes, we do have a big fun thing. It costs like, I want to say, about $15. Then you get to try like at least 6 different wines, and just know that half of that money is just going right back to the football club.
See, and that's the kind of neighborhood community that's sort of building. That's because you also do other stuff. I mean, you've been producing wines for Pride the last
10 years.
10 years. My gosh.
Well, this was actually our 11th year to be the wine sponsor for Pride. So what happens is we make a limited amount of 3 different wines: Out and Proud White, Loud and Proud Red, and then Sappho Sweet Delight. And we donate all of that wine to the bars. So whenever you buy a glass of wine or any alcohol at Pride, you're actually giving right back to Pride Northwest, because all that product is donated. Also, with our sales of those bottles, we actually donate 15% back to Pride Northwest as well.
Well, let's talk about wines for a minute.
Sure.
Because that's, I mean, we're in a winery and talking to a winemaker. This is I said on a show a while back that one of my favorite grapes that people are not so aware of is Viognier. I'm probably pronouncing it badly, but that grape with a V. It's not well known.
No.
But it's a wonderful little wine. You have a Viognier.
Yes, we do. Viognier is actually a Rhone varietal, which means it's a southern French varietal. It really likes warm climates, so it grows really well down in southern Oregon. It's relatively new to them. I think within the last 5 years, people have figured out that some of these
Rhone, French varietals grow really well down there in that nice warm climate. So I think within that, you know, the last 5 years, some of these lesser known varietals have been picked up by people and made, and people really enjoy them.
Yeah, I mean, I encountered it in a blend that I think from the Edgefield Winery some time back, and just realized that it was just really tasty. Mm-hmm. And you have some other ones too that Muscat is a grape that not a lot of people have a weird opinion of,
sure,
because they think Muscatel and the cheap kind of. You make a Muscat that I have never had anything pair with a curry better than the Muscat I picked up here. What are some of the other varieties you have that maybe people aren't so familiar with? I mean, obviously there's the Pinot Gris and the Pinot Noir.
Right.
I mean, everybody bloody right. their cousin has that.
Well, we definitely like Noir Saint Roussin again is another French Rhone varietal, that two French varietals that we produce here. And also Tempranillo, which is a Spanish varietal that, again, likes that warmer climate. Tempranillo is fun because it's almost like Pinot Noir's older, better-looking brother. It's kind of like Pinot Noir with attitude. So it's a fun one. People really like it, and it's, you know, just some different varietals. I think that's what we want to do, is focus on some different varietals maybe people haven't heard of, and also because our wine club pushes us to try these new varietals, because they want to try new things as well. So it's a great opportunity for us to, like, put that out there in front of them. If they like it, we'll make it again.
the Tempranillo, mm-hmm. I can fake my way sometimes through this wine stuff. I would say it's a nice, dark, full-bodied, hints of spice, nice, good fruit forward. Is any of that correct? Or?
Absolutely. Tempranillo actually tends to be more of a medium-bodied wine, but again, it's fun. Like Pinot Noir, it is all over the board. It really depends on the winemaking style that it's done with. So you can try somebody's Tempranillo and then try, you know, the next person's Tempranillo, and it's going to be different. So,
what do they mean by full-bodied?
Full-bodied just means the weight on your tongue. So, like, think of drinking a glass of milk. You know how it hangs out on your tongue a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah, see? So that's the body.
Oh.
Yeah.
So, like a range from milk to water.
Yeah, absolutely. Huh. Perfect.
So, if you have a medium body, would be a Tempranillo.
Yeah.
What would be what's a full-bodied wine?
Full-bodied wine could be Cabernet Sauvignon.
Okay. And what would be a thin-bodied? How do you?
Well, I would say light-bodied.
What's a light-bodied one?
Absolutely, Pinot Noir should be. I know that a lot of people make it in a different style. There, it's really full-bodied, but Pinot Noir actually should be more of a light-bodied wine.
No, is it Pinot? What's a Pinot Gris?
Pinot Gris is a white wine, and definitely, you know, a nice, again, very open to interpretation of how it's produced. Some people put it in oak, some people keep it in stainless steel, some people add sugar to it. So, again, all over the board. But, yeah, basically a light-bodied white wine.
Sugar, sweetness. Now, that's the thing. Part of that is up to the winemaker.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay. So, like, the Muscat, which, like I say, some people turn the nose up at the idea because they think it's a very, very cloying, sort of a sweet grape.
Right.
Yours is far from that. It's almost, I mean, it's semi-sweet, or?
Yeah, absolutely. Semi-sweet. Okay. Yeah. There's enough residual sugar there that brings out all of the fruit flavors to it. So you get the grapefruit, you get the apricot, you get the honeysuckle. So just more layers of flavor instead of just drinking something that's super sugary.
The Muscat, again, is one of my discoveries that was something I could use to pair with a nice spicy veggie curry.
Right.
I had no idea what to do. And it just worked. But what are some other food pairings? I mean, we have everybody who's ever heard of wine has heard of the bit about, let's see, it's white with fish and red with beef, but that's not always true. I know that once you start to learn about this stuff, you realize that all that stuff goes out the window. What are some pairings people might not think of? You do so much food with wine in your events. You've got to know some good tips.
Well, yeah, it's really nice. Pinot Noir always goes really well with salmon. because, again, either red or white goes well with salmon. So it's fun, interesting thing of the Marsan Roussan, those French Rhone varietals. It actually goes really well with seafood. So lobster, Dungeness crab sort of thing. And also, you know, a big, bold red actually can stand up to, like, lamb. Not people, you know, really don't think about, you know, pairing stuff with lamb, but it pairs really well with lamb, so.
I want to skip back. The Marsan Roussan you mentioned is, that's a white? That's a red?
That's actually a white. The two white varietals. Yeah, we blend. It's a 50-50 blend of Marsan and Roussan.
But the white versus red, that's really about the skins, isn't it? Or how does that work?
Yeah, that's very correct, because there's only basically two different grapes that actually have purple or red grape juice. The other one, that's where you get all of the color, is from the skin. So that's why you see people, you know, you have these big vats of red wine that have the grapes in them, because they're picking up the color for that wine from the skins.
And that probably explains some of the difference in the, well some of the difference in the color you
Absolutely. Because some grapes, of course, will give off a little bit more pigment. They have, you know, all of the right, chemical makeup, if you will, that gives more color. Like Cabernet, lots of phenolic compounds in there that gives it lots of color. Unlike Pinot Noir, where there's only like 8 phenolic compounds, so there's not much color there.
Tell me about some of the differences in the white colors. As you're getting, I mean, it's a kind of a yellowish gold-ish, but there's a variation in the colors. How does that happen?
That also happens with skin contact as well. Some people actually like an orange wine, if you will. Pinot Gris, where they actually, Pinot Gris is not a white green grape, it's actually a grayish pinkish grape. So if you let it sit on the skins, it's going to pick up a little bit of a pink or orange color to it. So that's that new phenomenon of orange wine. It's actually color comes from the skins.
Let me ask you, rosé, that's, you take the skins out part of the way? Is that how that works?
You can do that. That's called the Seigneur method. What happens with that is, Seigneur method is you're making a red wine, say Pinot Noir. And then in order to get that Pinot Noir a darker color, you'll actually bleed off some of the skin that has just a little bit of contact. So you're going to end up with a lighter color, and then you'll ferment that juice separately, so you can end up with, you know, a rosé-colored wine.
So is that how you do? You have a rosé, you have a blush. Is that how you do those, or is that a?
Well, that's not the way we do it. We actually, ours is blended. So what happens is we start out with red, okay, Zinfandel, and then we add Pinot Gris to it in order to make it pink.
Pretty straightforward that one. Zinfandel, is that? I Lodi, California is where I finally understood Zinfandel. I spent a few days trying to understand Zinfandel in Lodi. It was a lot of fun. Is Zinfandel grown very much up here in Oregon? Or?
Not very much. There are a few people down in southern Oregon, also the Gorge area that grows in. It's a really hard grape to grow. Little known. That is why white Zin became so popular in the 70s, because it's so hard to grow to get it to the right amount for red wine. So that's why people just, it's very prolific. You can just load up on the vines, and then you end up with, you know, your pink Zinfandel, right?
Wow.
So in order to get red, you got to be really on it, thinning and getting it to the right package that you need with all the sugars and the acids and everything. It's actually very hard to grow.
Let's go back to urban wineries for a minute, because I think that's a there's more than 20 here in the Portland area. Do you think that number's going to grow?
Absolutely, it's going to grow. It's growing every day. We actually have like 3 more that just moved into a space. So, yeah, I think it's just going to be a growing phenomenon of where people, there's a lot of small producers. Let's just say this in general. Oregon itself is growing at an awesome pace of just wineries in general. So there's a lot of small producers, a lot of new producers that are coming online every day, every year. I mean, we were bonded winery 300-something, and now there's like over 900 wineries. And that was 18 years ago, so grown exponentially. This is also a really young industry. Let's look at this. I mean, the wine industry here in Oregon has literally been around for the last 50 years. That's it. So we're just getting into it, I think.
Okay, bonded winery, that's different from virtual winery. Those are folks who are just like buying juice. Are you familiar with the virtual winery?
Well, the virtual winery would basically, you're making wine under somebody else's license. So that is what that means. So they're actually, you know, you're making wine, but yeah, doing it under somebody else's license. So
a little more. It's a bit more than just a vanity thing, slapping a label on something someone else.
It could be. Yeah, I mean that's just it. It's a pretty virtual winery is pretty loose for all sorts of things. You could be, you know, buying juice or, you know, just buying bulk wine or just buying, you know, shiners from somebody, which means basically unlabeled wine, and slap your label on it. Sure.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you find people are drinking these days? What kind of things are people picking up?
Well, our most popular wines are actually our red blends. People really love those. We have a red blend called Drop Dead Red, which is equal parts Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, and Tempranillo. Nice smooth red blend. It's been hands down one of our most popular wines, and we've been making it for 15 years. So people know what to get. You know, it's the same every time. And also our Wine Bunny Rouge, which is actually a fun little blend that's never the same blend twice. It's a four or five different varietals. It's always got a little spicy finish to it. So definitely our blends are the most popular wines here.
Do you find the so you got the one blend that you manage consistency, but the other blend you give it a little bit of a
zhuzh it up every time. It always has a nice spicy finish. Right now it's a blend of Pinot Noir, Zinfandel, Tempranillo, and I think that's it. Yeah. So
is that sort of just like depends on the mood you're in that particular season? Or?
Well, yeah, I think so. It's also what we get from each season and the different barrels we go through, and we try all the barrels and we just earmark ones that we're like, this would be perfect in this blend. It's nice and fruity. This has this sort of finish, or, you know, so definitely it is a very calculated blend, if you will. It's not just all the leftovers.
Now, most of your grapes come from Oregon. You get some from Washington. Where do you
actually source all of our grapes from Oregon right now. We work with 6 different growers all up and down the I-5 corridor right now. Some years we do dip into Washington, but it's been a good like 5 or 6 years since that. So
when I pulled up, I saw the barrels out front. Are you in between? What's happening with the barrels?
Well, outside, we're just getting ready for a harvest. It's basically what's happening. Everything's getting like steamed out, cleaned out, rinsed out, and, you know, getting ready for the grapes to come in, because certain people are already picking right now here in Oregon, absolutely. In the Willamette Valley, yes. We are not going to get any fruit in until around the beginning of October. So it's just, you know, everybody's in that mode of like, if they're not already crushing, they're getting ready to do that.
Hmm. And so it goes from the crush to the processing. How long does it take for wine to be, this is a terrible question, but I got to ask, how long does it take for wine to be ready? And if you say we'll serve no wine before it's time, I think we'll be in violation of a copyright somewhere.
At least. Well, it really depends on the varietal. So with white wines, generally about a year, 6 months to a year, depending on the style of wine that you're making. Reds can be anywhere from 8 months to like 5 years, depending on the winemaker style. Some people like to age theirs longer. Some people like to get it turned around and get it right in the bottle and make a light, fruitier style wine, so it's not as much barrel aging. So it's kind of all over the board.
Give me some closing thoughts.
Closing thoughts about urban wineries. I know that urban wineries are here to stay. I think it's a growing phenomenon. I think it's interesting that it actually has really grown within the last 5 years. Again, we were the only one for the longest time, and then other people actually did move into Portland. And I think, because that was back in 2006, so generally we were here by ourselves for the longest time.
Has it accelerated? Now that you mentioned it, have you seen it accelerate recently?
Absolutely. Like we said, within the last 5 years, most of these wineries have opened up. Laurie actually started the PDX Urban Winery Association, so there's 14, 15 of us that actually are marketing ourselves as PDX, you know, as a destination place. You don't have to go out to wine country to go wine tasting. You can try a whole world of wines just right here in Portland.
PDX Urban Wine Association. Tell me about that.
Well, it's a group of 14 different wineries that were formed back about 6 years ago. And we have a nice little passport map of where you get it. You know, go around, try the different wines at different wineries and that sort of thing. We market ourselves together. We have two PDX Urban Winery like events, if you will, where we get all of the wineries together in one area, one room or whatever, and you get to try like two or three different wines from each particular different winery, and that happens in December, and it also happens again in May, which is Oregon Wine Month.
Does it have a website?
Oh yeah, pdxurbanwineries.com.
And you've been at this for not quite 2 decades, but still.
It's, yeah, it's 18 years.
18 years. Wow. What did you want? What did you do before this?
Oh, I was actually a barista, if you will. I worked in the coffee industry for 10 years. I was the best barista at Portland back in 1995.
From coffee to wine, it's, I suppose, it's a natural evolution, really.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Morning drink to another morning drink, really. But that's being a little too honest. Okay, Renee Neely. Again, I've been speaking with Renee Neely from Hip Chicks Do Wine. She and her partner Lori Lewis have a winery down just off of Holgate in the industrial part of Portland. It is. Yeah, it's a lovely little space, and it's not that little. It's a lovely space, Renee, thank you so much for all your time.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's it for this edition of Free Culture Radio. I want to thank my guest, Renee Neely, from Hip Chicks Do Wine in Portland, Oregon. Many thanks to our engineer, and thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Free Culture Radio is produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. Free Culture Radio has a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/KBOO Free Culture Radio. Please give it a like. You can find links there to past shows, announcements about upcoming programs and events, and other stuff like news items that might be of interest. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. I'm Doug McVeigh. Good night.